It took a minute before Matt could speak. Burnham, it seemed to take a bloody hour before he could move. When he could, he snatched off his hat, strode to Tuon, and seized the razor's bridle. She looked down at him, cool as any queen on a bloody throne. All those battles with the flaming dice rattling away in his head, all those skirmishes and raids, and they had to stop when she said a few words. Well, at least this time he knew what had happened that was bloody fateful for Matt Bloody Cawthon. Why? I mean, I knew you were going to sooner or later, but why now? I like you. Maybe more than like you. And I enjoy kissing you, he thought Kareed grunted. But you haven't behaved like a woman in love. You're ice half the time and spend most of the rest digging under my skin. Love? Tuon sounded surprised. Perhaps we will come to love one another, Matrim. But I have always known I would marry to serve the Empire. What do you mean you knew that I was going to speak the words? Call me Matt. Only his mother had ever called him Matrim, when he was in trouble, and his sisters when they were carrying tales to get him in trouble. Your name is Matrim. What did you mean? He sighed. The woman never wanted much, just her own way. Like just about every other woman he had ever known. I went through a Tirangrial to somewhere else, another world maybe. The people there aren't really people. They look like snakes. But they'll answer three questions for you, and their answers are always true. One of mine was that I'd marry the daughter of the Nine Moons. But you haven't answered my question. Why now? A faint smile on her lips, Tuon leaned down from her saddle, and wrapped him hard in the top of his head with her knuckles. Your superstitions are bad enough, Matrim, but I won't tolerate lies. An amusing lie, true, but still a lie. It's the light's own truth, he protested, clapping his hat on. Maybe it would give him some protection. You could learn for yourself if you could make yourself talk to an Aes Sedai. They could tell you about the Aelfin and the Eelfin. It could be the truth, Edesina piped up as if she were being helpful. The Aelfin can be reached through a Tirangrial in the Stone of Tyr, so I understand, and supposedly they give true answers. Matt glared at her. A fat lot of help she was with her, so I understands and supposedlies. Tuon continued to stare at him as if Edesina had not opened her mouth. I answered your question, Tuon, so you answer mine. You know that Domani can tell fortunes? She gave him a stern look, like expecting him to call it superstition, but he nodded curtly. Some Aes Sedai could foretell the future. Why not a Domani? I asked Lydia to tell mine just before I landed at Ebu Dar. This is what she said. Beware the fox that makes the ravens fly, for he will marry you and carry you away. Beware the man who remembers Hawkwing's face, for he will marry you and set you free. Beware the man of the red hand, for him you will marry and none other. It was your ring that caught my eye first. He thumbed the long ring unconsciously, and she smiled, a small smile but a smile. A fox apparently startling two ravens in flight and nine crescent moons. Suggestive, wouldn't you say? And just now you fulfilled the second part, so I knew for certain it was you. Solution made a sound in her throat, and Tuon waggled fingers at her. The bosomy little woman subsided, adjusting her headscarf, but the look she shot at Matt should have been accompanied by a dagger in her hand. He laughed mirthlessly. Blood and bloody ashes. The ring was a carver's tri-piece, bought only because it stuck on his finger. He would give up those memories of Hawkwing's face, along with every other old memory, if it would get the bloody snakes out of his head. And yet those things had gained him a wife. The Band of the Red Hand would never have existed without those old memories of battles. Seems to me being Tavirin works on me as much as it does on anybody else. For a moment he thought she was going to wrap him again. He gave her his best smile. One more kiss before you leave. I'm not in the mood at the moment, she said coolly. That hanging magistrate was back. All prisoners to be condemned immediately. Perhaps later. You could return to Abu Dhar with me. You have an honored place in the Empire now. He did not hesitate before shaking his head. There was no honored place waiting for Lyalwyn or Doman, no place at all for the Aes Sedai or the band. The next time I see Seanchan, I expect it will be on the field somewhere, Tuon. Burn him it would be. His life seemed to run that way no matter what he did. You're not my enemy, but your empire is.
Nor are you my enemy, husband, she said coolly. But I live to serve the empire.
Well, I suppose you'd better get your things. He trailed off at the sound of a cantering horse approaching. Vanen reined in a rangy gray beside Tuon, eyed Kareed and the other Death Watch guards, then spat through a gap in his teeth and leaned on the high pommel of his saddle. There's 10,000 or so soldiers at a little town about 5 miles west of here, the fat man told Matt. Only one man Seanchan near as I could learn. Rest are Altarans, Terrabanners, Amadisians. All mounted. Thing is, they're asking after fellows wearing armor like that. He nodded toward Kareed. And rumor says the one of them that kills a girl that sounds a lot like the High Lady gets himself 100,000 crowns gold. Their mouths are dripping for it.
I can slip past them, Kareed said.
His bluff face looked fatherly. His voice sounded like a drawn sword. And if you can't, Matt asked quietly. It can't be chance they're this close. They've caught some sniff of you. One more smell might be all it takes to kill Tuon. Kareed's face darkened.
Do you intend to go back on your word?
A drawn blade that might be used soon. Worse, Tuon was watching, looking at Matt like that hanging magistrate in Truth. Burn him, if she died, something would shrivel up inside him. And the only way to stop it, to be sure it was stopped, was to do what he hated worse than work. Once he had thought that fighting battles, much as he hated it, was still better than work. Near enough 900 dead in the space of a few days had changed his mind. No, he said, she goes with you. But you leave me a dozen of your Death Watch guards and some of the gardeners. If I'm going to take these people off your back, I need them to think I'm you.
Tuon abandoned most of the clothing Matrim had bought for her, since she would need to travel light. The little cluster of red silk rosebuds he had given her she tucked away in her saddlebags, folded in a linen cloth, as carefully as if it were blown glass. She had no farewells to make except for Mistress Annan. She really would miss their discussions. So she and Seleucia were ready to ride quickly. Mylan smiled so broadly at the sight of her that she had to pat the little Damani. It seemed that word of what had happened had spread, because as they rode through the camp with the Death Watch guards, men of the band stood and bowed to her. It was very like reviewing regiments in Shondar. "What do you make of him?" she asked Kareed, once they were away from the soldiers and beginning to canter. There was no need to say which he she meant. "It is not my place to make judgments, High Lady," he said gravely. His head swiveled, keeping watch on the surrounding trees. "I serve the Empire and the Empress, may she live forever. As do we all, Banner General, but I ask your judgment." "A good general, High Lady," he replied without hesitation. "Brave, but not overly brave. He won't get himself killed just to show how brave he is, I think. And he is adaptable, a man of many layers. And if you will forgive me, High Lady, a man in love with you. I saw how he looked at you."
In love with her? Perhaps. She thought she might be able to come to love him. Her mother had loved her father, it was said. And a man of many layers. Matrim Cawthon made an onion look like an apple. She rubbed a hand over her head. She still was not accustomed to the feel of hair on her head.
"I will need a razor first thing."
"It may be best to wait until Abu Dhar, High Lady."
"No," she said gently. "If I die, I will die as who I am. I have removed the veil."
"As you say, Highness."
Smiling, he saluted, gauntleted fists striking over his heart hard enough that steel clanged on steel.
"If we die, we will die as who we are."
Chapter 37. Prince of the Ravens. Leaning on the tall pommel of his saddle, Ashandarai slanted across Pips's neck. Matt frowned at the sky. The sun was well past its noon height. If Vannon and those Death Watch guards did not return soon, he might find himself fighting a battle with the sun in the crossbowman's eyes, or worse, in twilight. Worst of all, dark clouds loomed over the mountains to the east. The gusting wind was out of the north. No help there. Rain would put the weasel in the henyard. Bowstrings fared poorly in rain. Well, any rain was a few hours off, with luck, but he had never noticed his luck saving him from getting soaked in a downpour. He had not dared wait until tomorrow. Those fellows hunting Tuon might have gotten another whiff of Kareed's men, and then he would have had to try attacking them or laying an ambush and carry it out before they could catch Kareed. Better to have them come to him at a place of his choosing. Finding the proper spot had not been difficult between Master Roydell's collection of maps on the one hand and Vannon and the other scouts on the other. Aludra was fussing over one of her tall, metal-bound lofting tubes, beaded braids hiding her face as she examined something at the broad wooden base. He wished she had been willing to remain with the pack animals like Tom and Mistress Annan. Even Noel had been willing to stay, if only to help Julin and Amathera make sure Olver did not run off to watch the battle. The boy was dead eager, which could soon lead to plain dead. Matters had been bad enough when only Harnan and the other three had been corrupting Olver, but now he had half the men teaching him how to use a sword or dagger, or fight with his hands and feet, and apparently filling his head with tales of heroes from the way he had been behaving, begging to go on raids with Matt and the like. Aludra was near as bad. Anybody could have used one of those strikers to light the fuse once she had loaded that tube, but she insisted on doing it herself. She was a fierce woman, Aludra was, and none too pleased at finding herself on the same side as Seanchan, however temporary the arrangement was. It seemed wrong to her that they would see some of her handiwork without being on the receiving end. Lyalwyn and Doman sat their horses nearby, keeping an eye on her, as much to make sure she did nothing foolish as to protect her. Matt hoped Lyalwyn did nothing foolish herself. Since there was apparently only one Seanchan with the people they would fight today, she had decided it was all right to be there, and the way she glared at Musenj and the other Death Watch guards, it seemed she might think she had something to prove to them. The three Aes Sedai, standing together with their reins in hand, cast dark looks at the Seanchan too, as did Blerick and Fenn, who caressed their sword hilts, perhaps unconsciously. Jolene and her two warders had been the only ones aghast at Shireen's willing departure with Tuon. What an Aes Sedai felt on any subject was usually how her warders felt on it, too, but the memory of being leashed had to be too fresh for Edesina or Teslin to feel comfortable around Seanchan soldiers. Bethamon and Sita stood very meekly, hands folded at their waists, a little apart from the sisters. Bethamon's light-colored bay nudged her shoulder with his nose, and the tall, dark woman half reached up to stroke the animal before snatching her hand back down and resuming her humble pose. They still would take no part. Jolene and Edesina had made that plain, yet it seemed they wanted the two women under their eyes to make sure of it. The Seanchan women plainly were looking at anything but the Seanchan soldiers. For that matter, Bethamon and Sita and Lyalwyn might as well not have existed for all of Musenj and that lot. Burn him, there were so many tensions in the air he could almost feel that hanging rope around his neck again. Pips stamped a hoof, impatient at standing in one place so long, and Matt patted his neck, then scratched the scar forming on his own jaw. Tuon's ointments had stung as badly as she said they would, but they worked. His new collection of scars did itch yet, though. Tuon. His wife. He was married. He had known it was coming, had known for a long time, but just the same. Married. He should have felt different somehow. But he still felt like himself. He intended to keep it that way, burn him if he did not. If Tuon expected Matt Cawthon to settle down, to give up gambling or some such, she had another think coming. He supposed he would have to give over chasing after women, much less catching them, but he would still enjoy dancing with them, and looking at them, just not when he was with her. Burn him if he knew when that would be. He was not about to go anywhere she had the upper hand, her and her talk of cupbearers and running grooms and marrying to serve the Empire.
How was marrying him supposed to serve the Flaming Empire? Musenge left the other 10 men and 5 Ogier in red and black armor and trotted his black gelding up to Matt. The horse had good lines, built for speed and endurance both, as far as Matt could tell without a thorough examination. Musenge looked built for endurance, a stocky, stolid man, his face worn but hard, his eyes like polished stones. "Forgiveness, Sinus," he drawled, banging a gauntleted fist against his breastplate. "But shouldn't the men be back to work?" He slurred his words worse than Seleucia, almost to unintelligibility. "Their rest break has stretched a long time. I doubt they can complete the wall before the traitor arrives as it is." Matt had wondered how long it would take him to mention that. He had expected it earlier. Open-faced, helmets off, but breastplates strapped on, the crossbowmen were sitting on the ground behind a long, curving wall, perhaps a third of a circle made of earth thrown up out of the 4-foot-deep trench fronting it, with a thicket of sharpened stakes driven into the ground in front of that and extending a little beyond the ends of the trench. They had finished that in short order. Infantry needed to be as handy with shovel, mattock, and axe as they were with weapons. Even cavalry did, but making horsemen believe was harder. Footmen knew it was better to have something between you and the enemy, if you could. The tools lay scattered along the trench now. Some of the men were dicing, others just taking their ease, even napping. Soldiers slept any chance they got. A few were reading books, of all things. Reading. Mandevin moved among them, fingering his eye patch and now and then bending to say a few words to a bannerman. The only lancer present, standing beside his horse, every line of him saying he had nothing to do with the crossbowmen, held no lance, but rather a long banner staff, cased for half its length in leather. It was perfect terrain for what Matt had in mind. Nearly 2 miles of grassy meadow dotted with wildflowers and a few low bushes stretched from the wall to the tall trees at the western end. To the north was a blackwater swamp, full of oaks and odd white-flowering trees that seemed half-thick roots, with a lake clinging to its western edge and forest below the lake. A small river flowed south out of the swamp, half a mile behind Matt, before curving away to the west on his left. A small river, but wide enough and deep enough that horses would have to swim it. The far bank lay beyond bowshot. There was only one way for any attacker to get at the wall. Come straight for it. "When they arrive, I don't want them stopping to count how many men in red and black are here," he replied. Musenge winced slightly for some reason. "I want them to see an unfinished wall and tools thrown down because we learned they were close. The promise of 100,000 crowns gold has to have their blood up, but I want them too excited to think straight. They'll see us vulnerable, our defenses incomplete, and with any luck they'll rush in straight away. They'll figure close to half of them will die when we lose, but that will just raise the chances for one of the others to get that gold. They'll only expect us to manage one volley." He slapped his hands together and Pips shifted. "Then the trap closes. Still, Highness, I wish we had more of your crossbowmen. I've heard you may have as many as 30,000. Musenge had heard him tell Tuon he would fight the Shan Chan too. The man was probing for information. "I have fewer than I did," Matt said with a grimace. His victories had hardly been bloodless, only remarkably close to it. Near 400 crossbowmen lay in Altaran graves, and close to 500 of the cavalry. A small enough butcher's bill considering, yet he liked it best when the butcher presented no bill. "But what I have is present for the day." "As you say, Highness." Messenger's voice was so neutral, he could have been commenting on the price of beans. Strange. He did not look like a diffident man. "I have always been ready to die for her." There was no need for him to say which her he meant. "I guess I am too, Musenge." Light, he thought he meant that. Yes, he did mean it. Did that mean he was in love? "Better to live for her, though, wouldn't you say? Should you not be donning your armor, Highness?" "I don't intend getting close enough to the fighting to need armor. A general who draws his sword has put aside his baton and become a common soldier." He was only quoting Comadron again, He seemed to do that a lot when discussing soldiering, but then the man had known just about everything there was to know about the craft. Just quoting, yet it appeared to impress the weathered man, who saluted him again, and asked bloody permission before riding back to his men. Matt was tempted to ask what that highness foolishness was about. Likely it was just some Seanchan way of calling him a lord. But he had not heard anything like it in Nebu Dar, and he had been surrounded by Seanchan there. Five figures appeared out of the forest at the foot of the meadow, and he did not need a looking-glass to know them. The two ogier in armor striped bright red and black would have told him, even if Vannin's bulk had not. The mounted men were at a flat gallop, yet the ogier kept pace, long arms swinging, axes swinging like a sawmill's drive shaft.
"Sling men, get ready!" Matt shouted. "Everybody else, go pick up a shovel!"
The appearance had to be just right. As most of the crossbowmen scattered to pick up tools and make a show of working on the trench and wall, 50 others strapped on their helmets and lined up in front of Aludra. Tall men, they still carried the short swords they called cat gutters, but instead of crossbows, they were armed with 4-foot-long sling staffs. He would have liked more than 50, but Aludra only had so much of her powders. Each man wore a cloth belt sewn with pockets slung across his breastplate, and each pocket held a stubby leather cylinder larger than a man's fist with a short length of dark fuse sticking out of the end. Aludra had not come up with a fancy name for them yet. She would, though. She was one for fancy names. Dragons and dragon's eggs. One by one, the men held up long pieces of slow match for her to light with a striker. She did it quickly, using each striker until the long wooden stick had burned down nearly to her fingertips. But she never winced, just dropped the thing and lit another, while telling the sling men to be faster, she was getting low on strikers. Light, but she was tight with the things. She had 5 more boxes that Matt knew of. As each man turned away from her, he put the smoking slow match between his teeth and secured one of the cylinders to his sling staff as he walked to the wall. There were wide intervals between sling men. They had to cover the whole length of the wall.
"Time to get your people in place, Musenge," Matt said loudly.
The Death Watch guards formed a single line abreast with the gardeners on the end. Anybody who took one glance through a looking-glass would know what they were. Light, all they needed was to see ogier in armor and the sun glinting off all that red and black. And if they stopped to think how few of the guards there were, they would still see they had Matt outnumbered, and there would be only one way to find out whether Tuon was with him. Vannin galloped behind the wall, flung himself out of the saddle, and immediately began walking his lathered dun to cool the animal down. As soon as he passed the wall, crossbowmen began dropping the tools and running to put on helmets and pick up crossbows. Those had been laid so that the men formed 3 spaced ranks with gaps where the slingmen stood. It no longer mattered if anyone was watching from the forest. What they saw would seem natural. Matt trotted Pips to Vannin and dismounted. The 2 human Death Watch guards and the 2 ogier went to join the others. The horses' nostrils flared with their heavy breathing, but the ogier were panting no harder. One was Hartha, a stone-eyed fellow who apparently ranked very close to Musenge. Vannin scowled at the men who had not gotten down to walk their horses. A horse thief he might be, reformed or not, but he disliked mistreating horse flesh.
"They went up like one of our night flowers when they glimpsed us," he said, nodding toward Aludra. "We made sure they got a good look at that fancy armor, then hightailed it as soon as they started getting mounted. They're coming hard behind us, harder than they should." He spat on the ground. "I didn't get a good look at their animals, but I doubt they're all good for that run. Some will founder before they get here."
"The more the better," Matt said. "The fewer who make it, the better in my book." All he needed was to give Tuon a day or 2 head start on them, and if that came from their ruining horses, if they rode out of the trees and decided he had too many men to take on, he would take that over a battle any day. After today's 6-mile gallop, they would need to rest their horses a few days before they were fit to travel any distance at all. Vannin directed that scowl at him. Others might go around calling him my lord and highness, but not Chell Vannin. Matt laughed and clapped him on the shoulder before swinging back into Pips's saddle. It was good there was someone who did not think he was a fool noble, or at least did not care whether or not he was. He rode to join the Aes Sedai, who were mounted now. Blerick and Fenn, the one on a bay gelding, the other on a black,
gave him stares almost as dark as those they had directed at Musenge. They still suspected he had something to do with what had happened to Jolene. He thought of telling Fenn that his stub of a topknot looked ridiculous. Fenn shifted in his saddle and stroked his sword hilt. Then again, maybe not.
"What I told you," Jolene was telling Bethamon and Sita, shaking an admonitory finger.
Her dark bay gelding looked a warhorse, but was not. The animal had a good turn of speed, yet its temperament was mild as milk water.
"If you even think about embracing Sidar, you'll regret it."
Teslin grunted sourly. She patted her white-faced chestnut mare, a much more feisty creature than Jolene's mount, and spoke to the air.
"She does train wilders and expect them to behave once out of her sight. Or perhaps she does think the tower will accept age over novices."
Spots of color appeared in Jolene's cheeks, but she straightened in her saddle without saying anything. As usual, when those two got into a conflict, Adesina concentrated on something else, in this case, brushing imaginary dust from her divided skirts. Enough tension to choke on. Suddenly, riders poured out of the trees at the far end of the meadow in a torrent that swelled into a spreading lake of steel-tipped lances as they drew rein, no doubt in surprise at what lay before them. It seemed that not as many horses had foundered as Matt had hoped for. Pulling the looking-glass from its scabbard tied to his saddle's pommel, he raised it to his eye. The Tarabonners were easy to pick out, with mail veils hiding their faces to the eyes, but the others wore every sort of helmet, rounded or conical, with face bars and without. He even saw a few ridged Tyran helmets, though that did not mean there were Tyrans among them. Most men used whatever armor they could find. "Don't think," he thought. "The woman is here. That 100,000 gold crowns is waiting. Don't bloody—" A shrill Seanchan bugle sounded, thin with the distance, and the horsemen began advancing at a walk, already spreading out to extend beyond the wall's edges.
"Uncase the banner, McCall,"
Matt ordered. So these flaming sons of goats thought they were coming to murder Tuon, did they? This time we'll let 'em know who's killing them.
"Mandevin, you have the command."
Mandevin turned his bay to face front.
"Stand ready," he shouted,
and under-officers and bannermen echoed the cry. McCall pulled the leather case off, carefully fastening it to his saddle, and the banner streamed on the wind, a red-fringed white square with a large, open red hand in the center, and beneath it, embroidered in red, the words, "Toiviandi se tovia sagain." "It's time to toss the dice," Matt thought, translating. And so it was. He saw Musenge eyeing it. He seemed very calm for a man with 10,000 lances coming toward him.
"Are you ready, Aludra?" Matt called.
"Of course I am ready," she replied. "I only wish I had my dragons."
Musenge shifted his attention to her. Burn her, she needed to watch her tongue. Matt wanted those dragons to be a shock when the Seanchan first faced them. Perhaps 1,200 paces from the wall, the ranks of lancers began to trot, and at 600 they began to gallop, but not as hard as they might have. Those horses were tired after a long run already. They lumbered. None of the lances had come down yet. They would not until the last 100 paces. Some of those carried streamers that floated behind them in the air. A large knot of red here, a clump of green or blue there. They might have been house colors, or perhaps they marked mercenary companies. All those hooves made a sound like distant thunder rolling.
"Aludra!"
Matt shouted without looking back. A hollow thump and an acrid sulfur smell announced the lofting tube sending its night flower aloft, and a loud pop, the blooming of a ball of red streaks overhead. Some of the galloping horsemen pointed to it as if in amazement. None looked behind them to see Talmanis leading the three banners of horse out of the forest below the lake. Their lances had been left with the pack animals, but every man would have his horse bow out. Spreading out in a single line, they began following the galloping riders, increasing speed as they came. Their horses had been ridden far last night, but not pressed too hard, and they had been rested all morning. The distance between the two groups of riders began to narrow.
"Front rank!"
Mandevin shouted when the horsemen were 400 paces away.
"Loose!"
Above 1,000 bolts flashed out, dark streaks in the air. Immediately the front rank bent to fasten their cranks to their crossbows, and the second rank raised their weapons.
"Second rank!"
Mandevin shouted.
"Loose!"
Another 1,000 quarrels streaked for the oncoming horsemen. At that range, they could not punch through a breastplate despite heads designed to do just that. But men with shattered legs toppled from their saddles, and men with ruined arms reined in frantically to try stemming the flow of blood. And the horses. Ah, light, the poor horses. Horses fell by the hundreds, some kicking and screaming, struggling to stand, others not moving at all, many of them tripping more animals. Catapulted riders tumbled across the meadow grass until they were trampled by the riders behind.
"Third rank! Loose!"
Mandevin shouted, and as soon as those bolts were away, the front rank straightened.
"Front rank!"
Mandevin called.
"Loose!"
And another 1,000 bolts added to the carnage.
"Second rank! Loose!"
It was not so one-sided as an ambush, of course. Some of the galloping horsemen had flung down their lances and uncased their horsebows. Arrows began to fall among the crossbowmen. Shooting accurately from a galloping horse was no easy task, and the range was too far at the start for the arrows to kill, but more than one man struggled to work his crossbow with a shaft jutting from his arm. The wall protected their legs yet. Too far to kill, unless your target's luck had run out. Matt saw a man fall with an arrow in his eye, another with a shaft taken in the throat. There were other gaps in the ranks as well. Men shuffled forward quickly to refill them.
"You could join in any time, Jolene," he said.
"Third rank! Loose!"
The Aes Sedai shook her head irritably.
"I must be in danger. I don't feel in danger yet."
Tesla nodded. She was watching the charge as if it were a parade, and not a very interesting one at that.
"If you would allow Sita and me," Bethaman began, but Jolene looked over her shoulder coldly, and the Seanchan woman subsided and dropped her eyes to her hands on the reins.
Sita smiled nervously, but it slid off her face under Jolene's stare.
"Front rank! Loose!"
Matt rolled his eyes to the heavens and muttered a prayer that was half-curse. The bloody women did not feel in danger. He felt as though his bloody head was on the chopping block.
"Second rank! Loose!"
Talmanis had come in range now, and announced himself with a volley from the 4,000 bows at 300 paces that cleared saddles. Closing the distance, they fired again, again. The enemy ranks seemed to ripple with the shock. Some men whirled about and charged at Talmanis's line, with lances coming down. Others began returning his hail of arrows with their own. Most continued on, though.
"Form square!"
Mandevin shouted a heartbeat before Matt could. He hoped the man had not left it too bloody late. The band was well trained, though. The men on the flanks fell back at the run, as calmly as if arrows were not pelting them, clanging off breastplates and helmets. And sometimes not. Men fell. The three ranks never lost cohesion, though, as they bent into a hollow box with Matt at its center. Musenge and the other human death guards had their swords out, and the Ogier were hefting their long axes.
"Slingmen!"
Mandevin shouted.
"Loose at will! Front rank! West! Loose!"
Slingmen along the western rank shifted their sling staffs so they could touch the fuses coming from the stubby cylinders to the slow matches held in their teeth, and, as the volley lanced out from the crossbows, whipped their slings back and then forward. The dark cylinders flew more than 100 paces to land among the onrushing horsemen. The slingmen were already fitting more of the cylinders to their slings before the first fell. Aludra had marked each fuse with pieces of thread to indicate different burning times, and each cylinder erupted with a roar and a burst of flame, some on the ground, some as high as a mounted man's head. The explosion was not the real weapon, though a man struck in the face was suddenly headless. He stayed upright in the saddle for 3 strides before toppling. No, Aludra had wrapped a layer of hard pebbles around the powder inside each cylinder, and those pierced flesh deeply when they hit. Shrieking horses fell to thrash on the ground. Riders fell to lie still. An arrow tugged at Matt's left sleeve. Another pierced his right sleeve, only the fletchings keeping it from getting through cleanly, and a third ripped open the right shoulder of his coat. He put a finger behind the scarf around his neck and tugged. The bloody thing felt awfully tight of a sudden. Maybe he should consider wearing armor at times like this. The enemy flanks were beginning to curl in now, preparing to envelop the crossbowmen behind the wall. Tomanus's men still peppered their rear with arrows, but several hundred men had been forced to drop their bows to defend themselves with swords, and it was unlikely that all of the horses with empty saddles out there belonged to Terrabanners or Amadisians. He had left a gap in the center of his line, a path for anyone who decided to flee. Yet no one was taking the offering. They could smell that 100,000 crowns gold.
"I think," Jolene said slowly, "yes, I feel in danger now."
Teslin simply drew back her hand and threw a sphere of fire larger than a horse's head. The explosion hurled dirt and pieces of men and horses into the air. It was about bloody time. Facing in three directions, the Aes Sedai began hurling fireballs as fast as they could swing their arms, but the devastation they wrought did nothing to slow the attack. Those men should have been able to see there was no woman matching Tuon's description inside the square by this time, but their blood was no doubt on fire, the scent of riches in their nostrils. A man could live the rest of his life like a noble with 100,000 crowns gold. The square was encircled, and they fought to close on it. Fought and died as volleys from the crossbows lashed them and slingmen killed them. Another wall began to rise, made of dead and dying men and horses, a wall that some tried to ride over and joined in the attempt. More scrambled down from their saddles and tried to clamber over. Crossbow bolts hurled them back. This close, bolts penetrated breastplates like hot knives going into butter. On they came and died. The silence seemed to come suddenly. Not quite silence. The air was full of the sound of panting men who had been working those cranks as fast as they could. And there was moaning from the wounded. A horse was still shrieking somewhere. Matt could see no one on his feet between the wall of dead and Tolmanis. No one in the saddle except men in green helmets and breastplates. Men who had lowered their bows and swords. The Aes Sedai folded their hands on the high pommels of their saddles. They were breathing hard, too.
"It's done, Matt," came Tomanus's shout. "Those who are not dead are dying. Not one of the fools tried to escape."
Matt shook his head. He had expected them to be half mad with the lust for gold. They had been completely mad with it. It would be necessary to haul away dead men and horses for Matt and the others to get out, and Tomanus set men to work, fastening ropes to horses to drag them aside. No one wanted to climb over that. No one but the Ogier.
"I want to see if I can find the traitor,"
Hartha said, and he and the other six gardeners shouldered their axes and walked over the mound of bodies as if it were dirt.
"Well, at least we settled this," Jolene said, patting her face with a lace-edged handkerchief. Sweat dotted her forehead. "You owe a debt, Matt. Aes Sedai do not become involved in private wars as a rule. I shall have to think on how you can pay it."
Matt had a pretty good idea what she would come up with. She was mad herself if she thought he would agree.
"Crossbows settled this, Marath Damani," Musenge said.
His helmet, breastplate, and coat were off, his left shirt sleeve ripped away so one of the other guards could wrap a bandage around where an arrow had gone through. The sleeve had come away very neatly, as if the stitching had been weak. He had a raven tattooed on his shoulder.
"Crossbows and men with heart. You never had more than this, did you, Highness?"
That was not a question.
"This and whatever losses you suffered."
"I told you," Matt said. "I had enough." He was not going to reveal anything more to the man than he could not avoid, but Musenge nodded as if he had confirmed everything. By the time an opening could be cleared so that Matt and the others could ride through, Hartha and the gardeners had returned.
"I found the traitor,"
Hartha said, holding up a severed head by its hair. Musenge's eyebrows climbed at the sight of that dark, hooked-nosed face.
"She will be very interested to see this," he said softly,
softly as the sound of sword being drawn is soft.
"We must carry it to her."
"You know him?" Matt asked.
"We know him, Highness."
Musenge's face, suddenly seeming carved from stone, said he would say no more on the subject.
"Look, would you stop calling me that? My name is Matt. After today, I'd say you have a right to use it.
Matt surprised himself by sticking out his hand. That stone mask crumpled in astonishment.
"I could not do that, Highness," he said in scandalized tones. "When she married you, you became Prince of the Ravens. To speak your name would lower my eyes forever."
Matt took off his hat and scrubbed fingers through his hair. He had told everyone who would listen that he did not like nobles, did not want to be one, and he had meant it. He still meant it. And now he bloody was one. He did the only thing he could. He laughed until his sides ached.
Epilogue. Remember the old saying. The red-walled room, its ceiling painted fancifully with birds and fish cavorting among clouds and waves, bustled with brown-clad clerks scurrying along the aisles between the long tables that covered the floor. None seemed to be trying to listen. Most seemed stunned with cause, but Suroth disliked their presence. They had to overhear some of what was being said, and it was potentially dire news. Galgan had insisted, though. They needed to work to keep their minds off the disastrous news from home, and they were all trusted men and women. He insisted. At least the white-haired old man was not dressed as a soldier this morning. His voluminous blue trousers and short, high-collared red coat with rows of gold buttons embossed with his sigil were the height of Shandar fashion, which meant the height of fashion for the Empire. When he wore armor or even just his red uniform, he sometimes looked at her as if she were a soldier under his command. Well, once Elbar brought word that Tuon was dead, she could have Galgan killed. His cheeks were smeared with ashes, as were hers. The ship Semirag had promised had brought word of the Empress's death and the Empire racked by rebellion in every quarter. There was no Empress, no daughter of the Nine Moons. To commoners, the world trembled on the brink of destruction. To some of the blood, too. With Galgan and a few more dead, there would be none to object to Suroth Sabel Mel'Darath proclaiming herself Empress. She tried not to think of the new name she would take. Thinking on a new name beforehand was bad luck. A frown creasing his face, Galgan looked down at the map spread out before them and placed a red lacquered fingernail atop mountains on the southern coast of Arad Doman. She did not know what the mountains were called. The map showed all of Arad Doman and held three markers, one red wedge and two white circles, spaced out in a long line north to south. "Has Turan gotten an accurate count of how many men came out of these mountains to join Iteralda when he crossed into Arad Doman, Yamada?" Ephraim Yamada wore the ashes, too, since he was of the blood, if only the low blood, his hair cut in the bowl and tail, rather than a narrow crest across an otherwise shaved scalp. Only the commoners around the table, whatever their rank, were without. Graying and tall in a blue and gold breastplate with broad shoulders and lean hips, Yamada still held some of the beauty of his youth. "He reports at least 100,000, Captain General. Perhaps half again that. And how many came out after Turan crossed the border? Possibly 200,000, Captain General." Galgan sighed and straightened. "So Turan has one army ahead of him and another behind. Very likely the whole of Arad Doman's strength, and between them he is outnumbered." The fool, stating the blindingly obvious. "Turan should have stripped Tarabon of every sword and lance," Suroth snapped. "If he survives this debacle, I will have his head." Galgan quirked a white eyebrow at her. "I hardly think Tarabon is loyal enough to support that just yet," he said dryly. "Besides, he has Damani and Rakan. They should offset his lesser numbers. Speaking of Damani and Rakan, I've signed the orders raising Tylee Kirgon to Lieutenant General and the Low Blood, since you've dithered over it, and orders to return most of those Rakan to Amadisia and Altara. Trison still hasn't found whoever created that little mess in the north, and I don't like the notion that whoever it was is lying in wait to spring out as soon as Trison returns to the Mulvane Gap." Suroth hissed, gripping her pleated blue skirts in her fists before she could stop her hands. She would not let the man make her show emotion. "You overstep yourself, Galgan," she said coldly. "I command the Forerunners. For the time being, I command the return. You will sign no orders without my approval."
You commanded the forerunners who have been subsumed into the return, he replied calmly, and Suroth tasted bitterness. The news from the Empire had emboldened him. With the Empress dead, Galgan intended to make himself the first Emperor in 900 years. It seemed he would have to die by tonight.
As for you commanding the return,
he cut off at the sound of heavy boots from the corridor. Suddenly, Death Watch guards filled the doorway, armored and hands on their sword hilts. Hard eyes stared out of their red and green helmets to survey the room. Only when they were satisfied did they step aside to reveal that the corridor was filled with Death Watch guards, human and Ogier. Suroth barely noticed them. She had eyes only for the small, dark woman in pleated blue with a shaven head and ashes on her cheeks. The news was all over the city. She could not have reached the palace without hearing of her mother's death, her family's deaths, but her face was a stern mask. Suroth's knees hit the floor automatically. Around her, the blood knelt. The commoners prostrated themselves.
"The light's blessings for your safe return, Highness," she said in chorus with the rest of the blood.
So Elbar had failed. No matter. Tuon would not take a new name or become Empress until the mourning was finished. She could still die, clearing the way for a new Empress.
"Show them what Captain Musenge brought me, Banner General Kareed," Tuon said.
A tall man with 3 dark plumes on his helmet bent to carefully empty a large lump from a canvas bag onto the green floor tiles. The gagging smell of decay began to permeate the room. Dropping the bag, he strode across the floor to stand beside Suroth. It took her a moment to recognize Elbar's hook-nosed face in that rotting mass, but as soon as she did, she fell forward, prostrating herself, kissing the floor tiles. Not in desperation, though. She could recover from this, unless they had put Elbar to the question.
"My eyes are lowered, Highness, that one of mine has offended you so deeply that you took his head."
"Offended me?" Tuon seemed to be weighing the words.
"It might be said he offended me. He tried to kill me."
Gasps filled the room, and before Suroth could more than open her mouth, the Death Watch guard Banner General planted a boot on her bottom, seized her crest in his fist, and hauled her upper body clear of the floor. She did not struggle. That would only have added to the indignity.
"My eyes are deeply lowered that one of mine should be a traitor, Highness," she said hoarsely.
She wished she could have spoken naturally, but the cursed man had her back arched till it was a wonder she could speak at all.
"Had I even suspected, I would have had him put to the question myself. But if he tried to implicate me, Highness, he lied to protect his true master. I have some thoughts on that, which I would share with you in private, if I may be allowed."
With a little luck, she could lay this to Galgan. His usurpation of her authority would help. Tuon looked over Suroth's head. She met Galgan's eyes, and Abeldar's, and Yamada's, and those of every one of the blood, but not Suroth's.
"It is well known that Zyred Elbar was Suroth's man completely. He did nothing that she did not order. Therefore Suroth Sabel Mel-Darroth is no more. This Darko Vale will serve the Death Watch Guard as they wish, until her hair has grown enough for her to be decent when she is sent to the block for sale."
Suroth never thought of the knife she had intended to use to open her veins, a knife beyond reach in her apartments. She could not think at all. She started screaming, a wordless howl, before they even began cutting her clothing off. The Andoran sun was warm after Tarvalen. Pevara removed her cloak and began tying it behind her saddle as the gateway winked shut, hiding the view of the Ogier Grove in Tarvalen. None of them had wanted anyone to see them leaving. They would return to the grove for the same reason, unless matters went very badly wrong, in which case they might never return. She had thought this task must be carried out by someone who combined the highest diplomatic skills with the courage of a lion. Well, she was no coward, at least. She could say that much of herself. "Where did you learn the weave for bonding a warder?" Javindra asked abruptly, stowing her own cloak in similar fashion. You should recall that I once suggested Red Sisters would be well served by having warders. Pavara snugged her red riding gloves, showing no concern for the question. She had expected it before this. Why would you be surprised I know the weave? In truth, she had needed to ask Yukiri, and had been hard-pressed to dissemble her reason for asking. She doubted that Yukiri was suspicious, though. A red bonding a warder was as likely as a woman flying. Except, of course, that that was why she had come to Andor. Why they had all come. Javindra was there only at Sutama's command, given when Pavara and Tarna could not come up with enough names to suit the highest. The angular sitter did not bother to hide her displeasure over that, not from Pavara, although she had buried it deeply around Sutama. Tarna was there, of course, pale-haired and icy cold, her keeper's stole left behind, but her divided gray skirts embroidered in red to the knee. For Elida's keeper to have a warder would be difficult, though the men were to be housed in the city, away from the tower. Yet it had all been her idea in the first place, and she was, if not eager, then determined to take part in this first experiment. Besides, the need for numbers was paramount, because they had found only three other sisters willing to entertain the idea. The primary task of the Red for so long, finding men who could channel and bringing them to the tower to be gentled, tended to sour women on all men. So the clues had been few and far between. Jezreel was a square-faced tyron who kept a painted miniature of the boy she had almost married instead of coming to the tower. His grandchildren would be grandparents now, but she still spoke of him fondly. Dasala, a beautiful Kyrianin with large dark eyes and an unfortunate temper, when given the chance, would dance any number of men to exhaustion in a night. And Melaire, plump and witty with a love of conversation, sent money to Andor to pay for her grandnephew's education, as she had for her nephews and nieces. Weary of searching out such tiny clues, weary of probing delicately to learn whether they meant what they might, Pavara had convinced Sutama that six would be enough to begin. Two, a larger party, might cause some unfortunate reaction. After all, the whole Red Aja appearing at this so-called Black Tower, or even half, might well make the men think themselves under attack. There was no telling how sane they all still were. That was one thing they had agreed on behind Sutama's back. They would bond no men who showed any signs of madness. That was, if they were allowed to bond any. Aja eyes and ears in Camelin had sent copious reports on the Black Tower, and some had even found employment inside it, so they had no difficulty locating the well-worn dirt track that led down from the city to a grandiose double-arched black gate near 50 feet tall and 10 spans wide, topped by crenellations over a down-pointing central spike of stone and flanked by a pair of thick crenellated black towers that stood at least 15 spans high. There were no actual gates to close up the opening, and the black stone wall that stretched out of sight east and west, marked at intervals by the foundations of bastions and towers, was nowhere higher than 4 or 5 paces that she could see. Weeds grew along the uneven top, and grasses ruffled by the breeze. Those unfinished walls, looking as if they might never be finished, made the gate seem ludicrous. The three men who stepped out into the opening were not at all ludicrous, however. They wore long black coats and swords at their hips. One, a lean young fellow with curled mustaches, had a silver pin in the shape of a sword on his high collar. One of the dedicated. Pavara resisted the instinct to think of him as equivalent to an accepted, and the other two as novices. Novices and accepted were kept safe and guided until they knew enough of the power to become Aes Sedai. By all reports, soldiers and dedicated were considered ready for battle almost as soon as they learned to channel, and they were forced from the first day, pressed to seize as much of Sidene as they could, made to use it almost continually. Men died from that, and they called it training losses, as if they could hide death behind bland words. The thought of losing novices or accepted in that fashion curdled Pavara's stomach, but it seemed that the men took it in stride. "A fine morning to you, Aes Sedai," the dedicated said with a small bow as they reined in before him. A very small bow, never taking his eyes from them. His accents were those of Murundi. Now what would Six Sisters be wanting here at the Black Tower this fine morning?
To see the Mahale, Pavara replied, managing to avoid choking on the word. It meant leader in the old tongue, but the implication of taking that alone as a title gave the word much stronger meaning, as if he led everyone and everything.
Ah, to see the Mahale, is it? And of what Ajahs, should I say?
The red, Pavara replied, and watched him blink. Very satisfying, but not very helpful.
The red, he said flatly. He had not remained startled very long. Well then. And Kazan, Alcine, you keep watch while I see what the Mahale has to say to this.
He turned his back, and the vertical silvery slash of a gateway appeared in front of him, widening into an opening no larger than a door. Was that as large as he could make? There had been some discussion about whether to bond men who were as strong as possible or those who were weak. The weak might be more easily controlled, while the strong might, would definitely, be more useful. They had reached no consensus. Each sister would have to decide for herself. He darted through the gateway and closed it before she had a chance to see more than a white stone platform with steps leading up one side and a squared-off black stone that might have been one of the building blocks for the wall, polished till it shone in the sun, sitting atop it. The two who remained stayed in the middle of the double arch as if to bar the sisters from riding in. One was a Saldaean, a skinny, broad-nosed man just short of his middle years, who had something of the look of a clerk about him. A bit of a stoop as from hunching for long hours over a writing table. The other a boy, little more than a child, who raked dark hair out of his eyes with his fingers, though the breeze quickly put it back again. Neither seemed the slightest uneasy over confronting Six Sisters alone. If they were alone, were there others in those towers? Pevara refrained from glancing at the tower tops.
"You there, boy," Dasala said in a voice like chimes. Chimes tinged with anger. The surest way to set off her temper was to harm a child. "You should be at home with your mother studying your letters. What are you doing here?"
The boy flushed bright red and raked hair from his face again.
"Samuel's all right, Aes Sedai," the Saldaean said, patting the boy's shoulder. "He's a quick learner, and you don't need to show him anything twice before he knows it."
The boy stood up very straight, pride on his face, and tucked his thumbs behind his sword belt.
A sword? At his age? True, a noble's son would have been learning the sword for several years at Samuel Alcine's age, but he would not be allowed to wear the thing about.
Pevara, Tarna said coolly. No children. I knew they had children here, but no children.
Light, Miller breathed. Her white mare sensed her agitation and tossed her head. Certainly no children.
That would be an abomination, Jezreel said.
No children, Pevara agreed quickly. I think we should wait to say more until we see Master...
the Mahale, Javindra sniffed.
No children. What? Aes Sedai, Enkazin asked, frowning. No children what? He said. When no one answered. He no longer appeared so much like a clerk. The stoop remained, but something in his tilted eyes suddenly seemed dangerous. Was he holding the male half of the power? The possibility sent a chill down Pavara's spine, but she resisted the desire to embrace Sidar. Some men who could channel seemed able to sense when a woman was holding the power, and Kazan looked like he might be hasty now.
They waited in silence except for the occasional stamp of a hoof, Pavara schooling herself to patience, Javindra grumbling under her breath. Pavara could not make out the words, but she knew grumbling when she heard it. Tarna and Jezreel took books from their saddlebags and read.
Good. Let these Ashaman see that they were unconcerned.
Only not even the boy seemed impressed. He and the Saldaean just stood there in the middle of the gate, watching, hardly blinking. After perhaps half an hour, a larger gateway opened, and the Mirandian strode through.
"The Mahale will be receiving you at the palace, Aes Sedai. Go on through."
He jerked his head toward the opening.
You will show us the way, Pavara said, dismounting. The gateway was larger, but she would have had to crouch to ride through. There'll be someone the other side to guide you, he barked a laugh. The Mahale doesn't associate with the likes of me. Pavara filed that away to chew over later. As soon as the last of them was through, near the white stone platform with its mirror-bright black stone, the gateway winked shut, but they were not alone. Four men and two women in rough woolens took the reins of their horses, and a dark, heavy-set man with both the silver sword and a sinuous red and gold figure, a dragon on his tall black collar, gave them a minimal bow. "Follow me," he said curtly in a Tyran accent. His eyes were like augers. The palace the Mirandian had spoken of was just that, two stories of white marble topped with pointed domes and spires in the style of Saldaea, separated from a large space of bare, hard-packed ground by the white platform. It was not large among palaces, but most nobles lived in buildings far smaller and less grand. Broad stone stairs rose to a wide landing in front of tall, twinned doors. Each bore a gauntleted fist gripping three lightning bolts, carved large and gilded. Those doors swung open before the Tyran reached them, but there were no servants in evidence. The man must have channeled. Pavara felt that chill again. Javindra muttered under her breath, with a sound of prayer this time. The palace might have belonged to any noble with a taste for tapestries showing battles and red and black floor tiles, except that there were no servants in evidence. He had servants, though unfortunately no red Aja eyes and ears among them, but did he expect them to remain out of sight when not needed, or had he ordered them from the halls, perhaps to avoid having anyone see Six Eyes Sedai arrive? That line of reasoning ran towards thoughts she would rather not consider. She had acknowledged the dangers before leaving the White Tower. There was no point dwelling on them. The chamber the Tyran led them to was a throne room, where a ring of spiral-cut black columns supported what must have been the palace's largest dome, its interior layered with gilt and half-filled with gilded lamps hanging on gilded chains. Tall, mirrored stand lamps stood along the curved walls, too. Perhaps 100 men in black coats were standing to either side of the room. Every man she could see wore the sword and the dragon. Men with hard faces, leering faces, cruel faces. Their eyes focused on her and the other sisters. The Tyran did not announce them, but rather simply joined the mass of Ashaman and left them to make their own way across the room. The floor tiles were red and black here, too. Taim must particularly like those colors. The man himself was lounging on what could only be called a throne, a massive chair as heavily carved and gilded as any throne she had seen, atop a white marble dais. Pavara focused on him, and not only to avoid feeling all those eyes of men who could channel following her. Mazrim Taim drew the eye. He was tall, with a strongly hooked nose and an air of physical strength about him, an air of darkness, too. He sat there with his ankles crossed and one arm hanging over the heavy arm of the throne, yet he seemed ready to explode into violence. Interestingly, though his black coat was embroidered with blue and gold dragons that twined around the sleeves from elbows to cuffs, he did not wear the collar pins. "Six sisters of the Red Aja," he said when they stopped short of the dais. His eyes. She had only thought the Tyran's eyes were augers. "Plainly you didn't come to try gentling us all." Chuckles rippled around the room. "Why did you come asking to speak to me?" "I am Pavara Tazanovni, sitter for the Red," she said. "This is Javindra Dorila, also a Red sitter. The others are Tarnar Fayir, Dasala Navanshi." "I didn't ask your names," Taim cut in coldly. "I asked why you came here." This was not going well. She managed not to take a deep breath, but she wanted to. Outwardly, she was cool and calm. Inside, she wondered whether she would end the day forcibly bonded or dead. "We want to discuss bonding Ashaman as warders. After all, you've bonded 51 sisters against their will.
as well to let him know they were aware of that from the start. We do not propose bonding any man against his will, however. A tall, golden-haired man standing near the dais sneered at her. Why should we allow Aes Sedai to take any... Something unseen struck the side of his head so hard that his feet left the floor tiles before he fell in a heap, eyes closed, and blood trickling from his nostrils. A lean man with receding gray-streaked hair and a forked beard bent to touch a finger to the fallen man's head. "He's alive," he said as he straightened, "but his skull's cracked and his jaw's broken." He might have been talking about the weather. None of the men made any move to offer healing, not one. "I have some small skill in healing," Melaire said, gathering her skirts and already moving toward the fallen man. "Enough for this, I think, with your permission." Taim shook his head. "You do not have my permission. If Mishraila survives till nightfall, he'll be healed. Perhaps the pain will teach him to guard his tongue. You say you want to bond warders? Reds?" That last word carried a great deal of contempt, which Pevara chose to ignore. Tarna's eyes could have turned the sun to an icicle, though. Pevara laid a cautionary hand on the other woman's arm as she spoke. "Reds have experience with men who can channel." Mutters rose among the watching Ashaman, angry mutters. She ignored that, too. "We are not afraid of them. Custom can be as hard to change as law, harder at times, but it has been decided to change ours. Henceforth, Red Sisters may bond warders, but only men who can channel. Each sister may bond as many as she feels comfortable with. Given the green, for example, I think that is unlikely to be more than 3 or 4. "Very well." Pevara blinked in spite of herself. "Very well?" She must have misunderstood him. He could not have been convinced so easily. Taim's eyes seemed to bore into her head. He spread his hands, and it was a mocking gesture. "What would you have me say? Fair is fair. Equal shares. Accept very well and ask who will let you bond them. Besides, you must remember the old saying, let the Lord of Chaos rule." The chamber erupted with men's laughter. Pevara had never heard any saying like that. The laughter made the hair on the back of her neck try to stand.
The end of the 11th book of The Wheel of Time.
Hi, this is Laura Wilson of Audio Renaissance, and I'm speaking with Robert Jordan. How did you decide to start writing the Wheel of Time series?
I began writing the Wheel of Time because a great many notions had been bouncing around inside my head, and they started to coalesce. I wondered what it was really like to be tapped on the shoulder and told, "You were born to be the savior of mankind." I didn't think it would be very much the way it is in so many books, where someone pops up and says, "Hi, I was born to be the savior of mankind, and here's the prophecy," and everybody says, "Oh, well, let's go then." I thought self-interest would play a big part. And I was also wondering about the source of legends and myths. They can't all be anthropomorphizations of natural events. Some of them have to be distortions of things that actually happened, distortions by being passed down over generations. And that led into the distortion of information over distance, whether that's temporal distance or spatial distance. The further you are in time or space from the actual event, the less likely you are to know what really happened. And then finally, there was the thought about something that happens in Tolkien and a lot of other places. The wise old wizard shows up in a country village and says, "You must follow me to save the world." And the villagers say, "Right then, Gov, off we go." Well, I did a lot of growing up in the country, and I always thought that what those country folk would say, "Oh, is that so? Look here, have another beer. Have two on me. I'll be right back. I will, really." And then slip out the back door. There were a lot of things that came together, and even once I started, of course, a lot of things built in and added in and changed.
What about this notion of time as a wheel? Is that your idea?
No, it's not mine. It is from Hindu mythology that time is a wheel. But actually, most Eastern cultures believed that time was circular. The Greeks gave us the great gift of believing that time was linear. And that's a great gift because if time is circular, if everything repeats in cycles, then change is impossible. No matter what you do, it's always going to come back to what is here. But if time is linear, then change is possible. But I wanted the circularity because I wanted, again, to go into the changes by distance. So the myths and legends and a few of the stories that these people tell, well, some of them are based on our own current events, on the present. What they are doing is based on our myths and legends. So they are the source of our myths and legends, and we are the source of theirs.
So what religions or mythological traditions are your stories based on?
Different religions, different mythologies. I felt that because America is a melting pot, I had at least some right to mine the mythologies of any nation that is represented in the United States, and also religion. So there are elements that come out of religious books, and there are elements that come out of mythologies as well. Not done in a mythological way. I try to present these things so that you feel you are in a place that is quite real and this could actually happen.
Tell me a bit about the idea of the one power.
In these books, there is the one power which comes from the true source. And the one power is what turns the wheel of time, the power that drives the universe. And the conceit is the one power actually consists of two quite separate halves that work with each other and against one another to produce the driving force of the universe. Men can tap into one side, women can tap into the other. A man can't teach a woman how to use the male half or how to use the female half, for that matter, and she can't teach him.
Are you an audiobooks listener? And if so, what sorts of books do you listen to?
I'm afraid the audiobooks I listen to are my own. I don't read my own books, but when I get the new audio tape, I listen to it because I get a different view. It is different than reading it.
So are you listening for a different interpretation of your work?
It's not so much the different interpretation. I want to have that one remove to see that I actually said what I think I said. You see, that's a problem that is very difficult for any writer. It's a problem that your editor helps you solve. You know what you intended to say. You know what you meant. And the fact that you perhaps didn't put it down clearly enough for someone who doesn't know what you meant to understand, that can be a problem. My wife, Harriet, is my editor, and she's very, very good at being able to say, you didn't convince me here, or I don't understand what you mean here. You have to do better. Because that's the point where I know what I meant, and because I know what I meant, it read fine to me. But to someone who didn't know what I meant, it didn't read fine. Well, I can also spot some of that in listening to the audio. And because I can spot it in listening to the audio, I know that, I thought I had put a bit of foreshadowing for something of the future here, and it doesn't come across clearly. I must do something about that in the next book to make sure that I do have that foreshadowing.
Well, thank you very much for talking with me. We hope you've enjoyed Knife of Dreams, an Audio Renaissance audiobook from Tor Books. Text copyright 2005 by the Bandersnatch Group. Production copyright 2005 by Audio Renaissance, a division of Holtzbrinck Publishers, LLC, and Books on Tape, Incorporated. All rights reserved.